All right, everybody, welcome to week two of Computer Science E52. So today we're going to be talking a little bit about the use of functions in C and what they're used for, how to use functions, and why they're useful. So basically functions, as you may have seen in lecture already, kind of provide a handy way for you to encapsulate your code. Maybe you have large blocks of code in your main functions, which are related somehow. They have a common purpose. Maybe it's a code block which is used again and again. An example of a code block that you see reused is something that might be encapsulated in like a while loop or a for loop. And if it's encapsulated within that, it might seem like it's fine to just leave it there. In many cases, it is. But if you see yourself reusing the same types of code and the same algorithms throughout your main function in different areas, it might start to seem like it's a little, redundant to keep repeating that so many times. So that's where functions can't come in writing clean, elegant C source code. It essentially allows you to take all that code, store it somewhere else, and then with the simple function call be able to take it, place it where you need it to be, and run it whenever it's called upon to do so in your algorithm. So that's essentially why functions are useful. So why don't we talk about how one would implement a function in the C source code. For example, how one would write a function. And so we see we have an example here. We have a program in which we want to take a variable x and then increment that variable. And this seems like the type of behavior which we could implement in the form of a function, which we would then call. We could call it square, for example. And then square would take an argument x, which is the integer we're taking in this program. And then presumably we would want the function to increase it by 1, to increment it, and then give us that value back. So this is in this particular example, since it's only being used once, we're not really seeing how useful functions can be. But if you had if you can imagine a program where you're incrementing a lot of variables, you're taking a lot of values and increasing them by 1, you can easily see how having something called increment that's easy to read, it makes sense. Square, the function square. To look at that, it's something that makes a lot of sense. You understand what exactly it means, what exactly it's doing, and it's not cryptic at all. So let's take a look now at how exactly we would go about writing this function square. Now, any function has to be written in a certain style and is typically declared before it's used in the main function. So we go up to our top of our file, and we see that we want to write a function which takes an integer x and then squares it, multiplies it by itself. So we see here we have kind of the basic layout of the structure of our typical function. It has to begin with a return type, then the name of the function, a couple curly braces, and included that we have the code block that makes up the function. And also the function name isn't sufficient really, because we need something that the function's going to act on. So I guess here we need a list of parameters, something that we're providing to the function so that it can do something with it, or else it would just be doing the same thing every time deterministically. So, so what do we mean by return type exactly? Okay, yes?
Well, we use int line or return 0 or something that comes back from the function.
Right, so this format looks kind of like what we're using here with our main function. We have int placed above main, and when we run our main function, it typically tends to return some kind of value, perhaps a 0 if it gets to the end of the function successfully, or if it doesn't quite make it there, we might return another number, which gives us a sense of what may have happened to terminate that. So functions work similarly in that when they complete, we're usually expected to return some type of value as an indicator of what happened with the function. So the return type at the top can be a standard data type in C. It can be something like an int. It could be, for example, a char, a float, or a double even, if you need to use that for some specific purpose. You could also make it be something else. What if you wanted to write a function that did something but didn't necessarily return a value? You wanted it to just have some kind of side effect. Like, for an example would be maybe if you wanted to write a function that was called, like, intro message, and all it did was print out some predetermined string to the screen. Okay, so the method by which you do that is instead of placing the name of a data type like int or char as the return type, you just type in something like void. You type in void specifically. And what that means is that the function doesn't return anything at all. It just has some type of side effect, like, for example, it prints something. So I'm not sure exactly how we're going to implement this at first, so let's just go with void kind of as a default for now, just as we work with this as a placeholder. So we have the name of our function. We'll call it square, like we said in our comment above. And we need to provide some parameters. So since we're acting on an integer, so we can just call it int x. So we're providing this int x to this function, which squares something. And then, so what should we do? How do we square this? We take this x value. It could be an integer 4, 3, something like that. And we want to make it a square of that. What could we write? Okay, so we could use our assignment operator, place our pre-existing value, whatever x was before, and then using the assignment operator, we can update that value and make it something like x times x. So this seems to take our value x and then set it equal to x times x. Is this doing what we want it to do? Does this seem like it's pretty much there? Okay, so we see we have this function now. It's defined. It's of type void. It doesn't return anything per se, but it takes this x value that we're feeding it as an argument to the function. It's one of our parameters. It squares it and places that where the previous value was within that function. Okay, seems pretty reasonable. So let's look at what the rest of the program is doing, since I haven't really walked through this with you yet. We're getting a positive integer from the user using our getInt function. We're running square x, which, as we saw above, supposedly takes in this value x, which we've already given it, and then multiplies it by itself, and then places it back in x. And then all this does is print out what the value of x is now. So everyone agree that this looks like it's pretty straightforward what it's going to do? Seems pretty simple. Can anyone identify any problems? Yes? Okay, so but if it's not returning anything, but we can say that we can see that it's of type void, and we're doing x equals x times x. So what's that doing if it's not returning anything? Is that a problem?
It's changing the x inside of the function, so that you printed it inside
of that function. Okay, so it's changing x in type inside of that function. So we're making some distinction between the x that exists within the function square and the x that exists within the function int, or the function main, rather?
Yeah.
Okay. And does everyone understand the reasoning for that? Why exactly there's a distinction between the two? So, I mean, we passed the variable x when we gave it to our square function into that function. So, it has the value, and it seems to be acting on it. So why would there be a problem? Why would we be seeing an issue because of the way? Sorry? It's an interesting idea, but it's not exactly the problem we're running into. So what we're seeing here is, and I'll demonstrate, I'll compile a program and show that your intuition is indeed right, that we're going to be running into some type of problem because of this variable scope issue. So if we run function 1 here, it's waiting for me to type in an integer. I'll give it 4. So it runs that square function on the number 4. The function seems to take it and assign to the variable x times x, which should be 16. But then when we're printing out the value of x later on in our main function, we still have the number 4. So what's going on here? Well, the reason is that when we pass a variable into a function, for example, square in this case, what's actually happening is that we're not telling the square function exactly where the value we'd previously stored in x lives in memory inside the computer. There's this region of memory called x now within the main function. This is look at this as the memory in the computer and where we're storing all our variables. The way this works when we're calling function is that there's different scopes of memory living on what is called the stack, which is a region of memory reserved for all the variables which are found within our program. And this first region is reserved for the function main. And in main, we've declared a variable x, and we gave it the value 4. So inside main, we have x equals 4. And then when we call our function square, this generates another region on the stack. And it's passed the value x equals 4. But this is a different x, because it exists within a different scope. This is called a pass-by value. When we give square the parameter integer x, what we're really doing is giving it the number 4 and letting it, when we say int x, we're just saying, okay, go to x, get the value there, take it. And then in the definition of square, you will see that we just happen to call that local parameter that we get there int x. If I were to change that to int y and make this y equals y times y, you can see that it's actually a different local variable. This is still completely valid. And I could pass a parameter named anything that you can imagine, as long as it's still an integer, into that function. And it would still be able to handle it because it would be expecting that the first argument it receives would be some integer y, a value which is an integer. And it would take it, assign it to the local variable y, and then act on it. So what we're seeing happening here is that, we'll call this y now, just because we've changed our source code. It's taken this argument x, looked at it, found out the value's 4, passed by value to the function, the square function, and then it executes the line of code that says y equals y times y. This becomes 16, and as he noticed, the function then terminates without returning anything. So unfortunately, what we see happening is this is all just completely erased, dereferenced in memory, and we no longer have access to anything there. When we go on back in our main function to try to print what we have stored in x, we find 4. It's as if nothing ever happened, and our function is more or less useless because it doesn't accomplish what we set out to do. Okay, so it seems like we had better find out a way to fix this, because we still want to make use of the benefits of functions and try to encapsulate our code a little, make things a little more legible, easier to handle within our main function. So how might we go about addressing this problem? Any ideas?
Say return y.
Okay, so you're suggesting that after we change our value of our y, our local variable y, which stores the integer we're working on in the square function, that we could return it. This seems like we're heading in the right direction. So we'd have to change something else in the function if we want to do this.
We have to change its data type to integer.
Yeah. So now the return type is an int because we are handing the program which called this function back an integer. And what that essentially means when we return something is that means that this function call, square x, which consists of the name of the function and then the arguments being passed to it included in these parentheses, that's going to evaluate something. This is going to be run, and it returns a value. So how do we use that value? This presumably we hand in a 4 like we did before at a square, and this is going to evaluate to 16, the square of 4. So what can we do with it now? How is it useful to us? Exactly. You can actually use the assignment operator with a function call, x equals square of x. And what this does is it looks at the variable x and then takes the value stored there, hands it to the square function, which then assigns it to a local variable, which is completely separate in memory, multiplies it by itself, returns that. So now square x evaluates to whatever the square of x actually was, like we want it to behave, and assigns it to x. 4 becomes 16, and our assignment's complete. So let's take a look. Does this seem right to everyone? Any other problems here, or is this pretty much starting to look pretty simple?
What's the
return 0? Return 0? That's a fairly typical convention. At the end of your main function, if you've gotten through everything you want to do in the function, you just return 0. It indicates that the program exited successfully. It's just if you think of main as a function in and of itself that's called by the operating system, and you'll see when you start providing command line arguments that it behaves more like a function in C than you might have previously thought. It just lets the operating system know that things have completed successfully. And if you were to return some other number somewhere else in the function, someone who's clever might be able to look at what number is being returned and figure out what might have gone wrong with the program, perhaps a developer, and then they could see where a bug might exist in their source code and do something to resolve it. So returning 0 at the end is just a convention. Any other questions before we continue? Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look at what happens when we run fun1 now, just to see if what we did is correct. We have a prompt here. I'll type in 5 this time. And our number squared is 25. So we've successfully used a function to kind of encapsulate some of our code to make a call to it and get the return value in order to do something with our code that we had not been able to do when we weren't using a return value.
You know, I got to put in the next assignment, part of it is return something other than zero if it doesn't work out. And I mean, I guess it's a return. Let's say it goes successfully and we return. Can we still return it a four?
You could. It's the convention generally is that you want to return zero if the program exits successfully, and return other numbers if there's some other issue. The numbers varying depending on what the circumstances may have been. You could conceivably return a four. You'd be spurning convention a little bit, and you might confuse someone down the road. But there's no reason that you absolutely can't do that.
Yeah. I was thinking more kind of unintentional.
Oh yeah, I mean certainly that's doable. It's not necessarily a good idea all the time, but. Okay, so let's before we move on, let's look at we looked at functions just now as a way we can encapsulate our code and make things a little easier to deal with, and we were storing all of our functions at the top of the file. Does anyone know the particular reason why we're keeping our functions at the top of the file rather than sticking them at the bottom below main? It seems like that might be a little more desirable at times. So, if we were to take this file where we have a few functions at the top, and we have to scroll all the way through all of them before we can get down to main and see what the program's actually doing when it's running. It's kind of unintuitive to have to look at all these under-the-hood functions that are doing the bare bones of the program and not know what's really being called first before we scroll all the way down to the bottom of the file. So, I mean, if we were just to take one of these functions and go down to the bottom of the file just to get it out of the way and put it below main, this seems like it'd be a good idea because it kind of makes it easier to get to the real meat of the program and see what's happening before you're looking at the other codes. But what happens if we try to do that? Okay, so we get something called an implicit declaration of a function. And the reason GCC throws this up at us is that in the C programming language, the program always wants to know what exactly the function is doing, what types of arguments it takes, what it returns, before it lets you start using it within the program. It just won't accept any other order than that. So we're kind of stuck with an unfortunate situation where in order to make use of these functions, we have to keep listing them at the top of the file, and our main function just gets harder and harder to get to. Now, fortunately, there is a solution to this that makes things just a little bit simpler for us, and it's a method by which we can kind of declare the function without actually explicitly listing out all the code which occurs. Has anyone heard of something like this, maybe mentioned in a lecture at some point? So you can define the function right at the top without including the entire code block. And the way you do this is just by writing up. Just take a look at this function. If we want to do that with this, we see that it's of return type integer. It's called getPosInt. It takes no arguments. So we just go to the top of the file above our main function. And we would just write int getPosInt, the name of the file, the function rather. Parentheses including any arguments. Since there's no arguments for this, we just have these open parentheses with nothing inside. And then end it with a semicolon like we would a variable declaration like int x or double s, anything else. And we can actually repeat this for everything else. We have, in this code, we've just included this pretty print function just for the benefit of including another function to demonstrate how cluttered this can get. And this just prints the squared value within these underscores and vertical lines. And this can also be taken out and moved to the bottom of the code, as well as this square function. And we see now, we just need to declare these at the top now. So we would place void prettyprint int x and I believe int square int x at the top of the file with the semicolons. And then we can see it's a lot easier to get to our main function now. What we're really doing in the program, the way everything flows together, is a lot more visible to the reader upon opening the file. It just seems like stylistically things are a little better. It makes it a lot easier to edit what is going on and keeps the functions kind of out of the way, which is better unless you're writing the functions or changing them explicitly at the moment. So let's just see if this still runs the way we want it to. Make fun 2. The compiler seems to accept it. Does everything still function the way that it should? Enter a positive integer. We'll try 6 this time. Your number squared is 36. The program still runs. So it's just a different way of declaring your functions if you wanted to place them lower. And when you see functions that you'll be working on later where the code blocks are much longer than 2 or 3 lines, they can get to be pretty involved. This is something you're really going to want to make use of, because having all those lines of code at the top of your file after you've completed them and know they work and have debugged them is just a little annoying at times, and it makes it more difficult to edit other parts of your file. Does anyone have any other questions about how the syntax works or why it works the way it does?
I recall in the sort of source code set that was with last week, lectures on before declaring or defining a function like a top, there was a sort of like pound sign define for it.
Pound sign define is actually used for something slightly different. I'll show an example of that actually just right now. If I were to some file.c. If I were to start writing a C file right now, I would normally put a sharp include stdio.h. In this class, I'd probably put sharp include cs50.h to make use of the library functions we have. And these are all preprocessor commands, the ones that start with the sharp sign. And this just basically means these are what's done first, just to prepare the file so the compiler can run through it and get your program ready. And one of the commands you can use is sharp define. And after you type in sharp define, you would type in some word, typically all in caps, and you might call it like max num or something like that, the maximum number for some array or something like that. And then you would assign it a value. Say you wanted the max number to be 7. And what that would essentially do is make the compiler, before it begins compiling your code, run through the entire file, and everywhere it sees the phrase max num, it would actually just plug in the number 7 and do that for the entire file. So it would be as if you had just put the number 7 there. The reason we do this is because if you were to hard code 7 into a bunch of different places in your code, it's not exactly clear why you're using the number 7, and if you ever decide you want to upgrade and use the number 8 instead, then you have to hunt down everywhere you've used 7 and change the digit, whereas if you use max num, it's as simple as going to the top of the file and changing this magic 7 into an 8 or any other digit. That's just something that's fairly useful, and it's good form to get in the habit of using it. Does anyone else have any questions about this or anything related? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about arrays. Does anyone have a concept of like what exactly arrays are? Maybe someone made use of an array on the first problem set for some reason. Okay, so arrays are... think of the way that we store data in the computer. We take a variable, we declare it. Maybe we'll have like integer x, and we declare this variable, so the computer goes into the memory, it finds a space to store an integer, and refers to that space as x. And so we might have x, and we can represent it just with this die, and it has some value. So the die represents the variable, and whatever face is facing you represents the number that it's currently set to. So you have x, which is the variable, the location in memory where a value is being stored, and you have 4, the value that's stored there. So, okay, now we have a single variable which can store a number. We can change it to something else. We can change it to 1. We can change it to 3. It's fairly useful, but within certain limits. If I wanted to store a second number, then I would have to declare a second variable. Now I have x, which is set to 3, and then I have maybe y, and I can set this to 5. And if I need to get a third number and keep track of that as well, then I need a third variable name. And as n gets larger, that gets a lot more cumbersome, and soon you're juggling all sorts of variable names, which is just very difficult to deal with. And especially if these variables are linked somehow in a conceptual manner, it seems really silly to have to come up with a different name for all of them instead of just storing them together somehow. So we introduced the concept of arrays. Now, an array is a set of similar data variables which are stored together in memory. So where you may have once had this single piece of memory that stores one integer, you would have an array which is capable of storing a set of these, a certain number of these same pieces of data together in memory. So let's take a look at how would you you would initialize an array. So assuming that the... Oh, I'll just type it in. I'm not going to bother typing in the preprocessor commands just because we're not going to compile this. This is just a demonstration to show how you can declare an array. So suppose we wanted to declare an array and we wanted it to be capable of holding 7 integers. So much in the same way that we declare a normal variable, we type in its type, then the name we want to give it. But this isn't sufficient to declare an array. We still need to know how many of these variables we want to store together. What's the size or length of our array, essentially? So with this array declaration, we just type in a left square bracket, then the number of elements we want to keep track of, and then an and square bracket. So we have int numbers 7. And that essentially gives us this. So where once we add these just separate, distinct entities, which are each holding a variable value, we have these 7 different index values, which we can address by the index number at which they're held within numbers, and see a different distinct value there. So for example, if I were to open up number 0, okay, so I have the value 4 there. And I could jump to any other any other address within the array. I can jump to index 4, which is actually the 5th element. Keep in mind that in this class, we're generally going to be counting from 0, especially in terms of addresses within arrays and index values. I can jump to numbers 4. And I see we have the number 1 stored. So in this way, we're able to refer to this array as just kind of by one name, but look at different parts of it to see up to 7 different values numbered 0 through 6. And so programmatically, if I wanted to see what the value of the first entry, which is number 0, how do you think I'd refer to that? What's the... say I wanted to... I had an integer x, and I wanted to get the first element in numbers and assign that to x. What seems intuitive here? Maybe nothing. I don't know.
numbers, open bracket, 0, close bracket.
That's precisely what you do, actually. So much in the same way that you use the square bracket to declare the array, you use a square bracket to reference a position within an existing array. So by typing in x equals number 0, we're assigning to x the whatever value happens to be stored in the 0th index of this array that we've called numbers. So the reason we would count from 0, it seems kind of unintuitive. It might be popping you a lot of your heads, so why don't we just label them 1 through 7? That's how real people think. That's how real people would address this situation. The reason for that, and it'll become more clear as we start talking about other concepts like pointers in the future, is that when we're referring these index to these index values, we're really thinking about how far they are away from the beginning of the array. So this is 0 away from the beginning of the array. This is 1 away from the beginning of the array. And it's just like a number line running underneath them. And you're referring to the number that's on the left of whatever this entry is. And if that helps you to think about it a little easier, no, you should think about it that way. If not, just remember that we're labeling these as 0 through 6 when we have 7. And also keep in mind that it's just an important point that kind of is, it seems like a contradiction when you look at it and is a bit of a mismatch. When we are declaring our array, we place the exact number of entries, 7, as opposed to 6, which is the last index value, but we do not have access to number 7. You only have access to 0 through 6. And this is not because C will not let you access that point, but just because you should not. And I'll get to why you shouldn't in a moment. We're going to see in a demo I'm going to be doing. So I've prepared a file called array1.c. It's a really simple program. Essentially what it does is it declares an array of size 7, which holds 7 integers. There's an index value, and what this essentially does is it loops forever. It prompts you to give it an index value, and then it looks up that index value in the array. So it's of size 7. You type in presumably 0 through 6, and it would open this and tell you what exactly is inside. But that seems a little weird because, as you can see, we've just declared our array and we haven't really put anything in it. So it seems like a pretty uninteresting program since it's just going to be looking at this empty array, and I don't even know what it's going to print, really, because nothing's been done. So let's go ahead and make array one, run it. I guess we'll just look at the first element of the array, the zeroth index. That's a really large number to just be placed somewhere in an array that I just declared and haven't put any numbers in. So let's see what else we have. We have one, that's an extremely small number. Two, another huge number. Three, four, five, six. Okay, so every element in the array I just declared has these outrageously large or small numbers just sitting there for seemingly no reason. And the reason for this is that the way that memory management works in the C programming language is that when you declare an array or an integer, you need to initialize it to something, or you're going to end up with whatever was already there. You're essentially being assigned a space in memory, which is just a bunch of bits and bytes which are sitting there, but these ones happen to be yours. But they weren't always yours, and something's been done with them by the computer. Those bits are still switched to ones or zeros. They store some type of number. And the computer does not go through and just set them all to zero for you to save you the trouble of having to do it yourself. So anytime you get you want to declare an array and you were counting on them being initialized to some value, maybe you want them all to be zero and start like incrementing one at a time. Like for example, if I wanted to keep track of like the frequency of, you know, if this is Sunday through Saturday and I want to keep track of the frequency of students who go to section on different days and I want to add one to each of them, I need to set all of these to zero first or else I'm going to be incrementing one to, 134,519,936, and few enough people showed up to sections in this class as it is, so you're probably not going to have that many. So that's just a very important note to keep track of. So how would you do that exactly? How exactly do you assign a value to an array? You can't just say number 7 equals 0, can you? Because is that like you're setting an entire array to a null value? So what you actually... Yeah, go ahead.
So you don't just do it in one kind of... one line. Even you do maybe do a for loop.
Okay, so you're suggesting we could loop through each index value or address in the array and then assign them a zero value?
Yeah, or is there any way to do it kind of all at once? Just...
That's actually... what you suggested is actually the best way to address this problem. So if I wanted to take this array and then do something to every element, like resetting them to zero... the absolute best way of solving this problem is to use a for loop, set up a counter, set that less to the maximum size, 7 in this case. And then what do I want to type? I need to do something these 7 times, but what is it? Okay. So... the way we reference a position in the array in order to give it a value is once again actually very similar to the way that we would reference the value held there. So you actually just type in numbers and then in square brackets the index value we want, not sure what we want to put there, and then set that equal to, in this case, 0, because we want to initialize the array to contain all zeros. So what do we want to put for our index value? X. Yeah. You can use an array as an index value in when you're assigning values to a space in an array. That's completely acceptable. And in the case of for loops or any other type of loop, it's extremely useful because it lets you essentially iterate over each element of the array and do something unique at each element. I could, just to get you thinking about it, set each element equal to x. I could give each element the index value there. I can make it x squared. Then I'd have a list of all the squares. I could really put anything in there I wanted. It could be dependent on a variable or not. And this is just a handy thing to remember to initialize your array to contain all zeros if you're depending on the values there being zero, because you definitely cannot count on that being true. So I'm not going to save that. See if I preserve that. Okay, so there's another important lesson that can be learned from this little program. So we went up to 6, and we saw that we could access that information. We can get to that. But I told you that we only have these seven elements in the array, and beyond that, we don't really know what's going on. And behind that, in fact, because you can have negative index values, we don't really know what's going on. So It seems like we shouldn't be able to access anything beyond 6 because that's just not in our array. Our array does not extend here. There's no die to look at. So what if I put in 7? Okay, I just got the number. It happens to be 7. If I type in 8, that's just a random number that happens to be stored there. And what's actually happening is that this exists in memory, and there's more memory here. It's just not part of the array that I've defined, and I can't really say anything specific about it. And the computer can put anything it wants here. It can store my other variables here. If I had like an integer y or a character c, it could place it right next to it, and I'd never know. And if I overreached and tried to set something to number 7, I could actually overwrite that value and lose it completely. So I have to be careful about how I extend outside of my array. And even worse, if I go out far enough, I might get into some write-protected region of memory where I'm not supposed to access. It's protected, and the computer does not want me to touch it for whatever reason. Apparently farther out than 100. Farther than 1,000. All right, I'm getting lucky with this one. Okay, and you get what's called a segmentation fault, and it dumps the core. Has anyone seen this error yet, thrown at them from a program? You're going to, I promise. So when you start working with arrays, if you have some bug for some reason and you're trying to reach out beyond the scope of your array to memory that maybe you shouldn't be messing with, you're going to end up getting what's called a segmentation fault. And this is the way that the computer tells you that, okay, you're reaching into memory you should not have access to, and the program has been stopped to prevent that memory from being altered. So if you ever see this, you're going to want to go through your code very carefully and just figure out where you might be reaching into memory that you should not have access to and how you can correct it. It's usually some type of conditional that you're not checking correctly, or your variable's doing something that you don't necessarily expect them to do, being values that you didn't anticipate. Corner cases, that type of thing. Okay. Okay, so there's also things called multi-dimensional arrays. Now, we have a single dimensional array, and it just has this one index value that maps to a specific point and contains a certain value. It's just a list of numbers, essentially. It's pretty simple conceptually. So, how might we represent a multi-dimensional array? Say it's a two-dimensional array. I guess then it would have two index values. So, in code, if I wanted to declare a multi-dimensional array with a two-dimensional array, we'll stay with type int, call it numbers 2. We still use the square bracket, and I want this one to be 5 long on this dimension. But you use 2 square brackets. Make this 5 as well. Okay. So does anyone have an idea as to what this might imply? Why we have 2 index values as opposed to just 1?
Great.
Hmm?
Great.
Yeah. A two-dimensional array can be very easily represented geometrically, kind of, and thinking about it that way, we end up with a two-dimensional grid of sorts with 5 columns and 5 rows. And you can think of this first index value as being indicative of your rows, and the second one being indicative of your columns, or the other way around. It doesn't actually matter. There aren't actually rows and columns of memories inside the computer. It's all the way you're thinking about it. But let's say this is our x, so to speak, our left and right, and this is our y, up and down. So if we were to go to 0, 0, and write maybe numbers square bracket 0, numbers square bracket 0, and set that equal to 4, we'd go to our 0th row, our 0th column, and we'd place a 4 there. And say we want it, we're just give me 2 numbers between 0 and 4.
2 and 3.
2 and 3, okay. So 0, 1, 2. 0, 1, 2, 3. And maybe we set that to 7. So it goes to this position in memory, places it there. So it's just a different way of kind of conceptualizing your data within the memory in the computer. Now, you might think that you could... Can you see how you could actually conceptually store this within a single dimensional array as well? Yeah, you could just make it linear. You could just have an array with 25 entries And it'd really be doing the exact same thing. So why might a multidimensional array be more useful in certain circumstances?
It's just conceptually easier to keep track of.
Exactly. It's just an easier way to look at something similar. And also there are some practical applications, because if I wanted to maybe access the data all in this column, so to speak, I could just do a for loop which iterates over this index value, places different values there, and I'd be able to get to everything here while maintaining the same constant here. And if you were to do some kind of program which involved something that actually was a grid, like we might, unless we change the problem sets, we might have an upcoming Sudoku problem, it seems like the best way to store a board, maybe a 9x9, which contains the numbers, would be to use a multidimensional array, because then when you're looking at it, you can easily kind of visualize where exactly each is going to be stored. So can we only do two dimensions, or can we go up to 3, 4? You can actually have as many as you want or need. Above 2, you would, I guess, each number would be occupying a different point in three-dimensional space. Don't worry about trying to visualize it that way, because there's not really a good reason to in this course. And at 4, you can't think about it traditionally, geometrically. But
so when you initialize it,
yes.
You know, so let's say a multidimensional one. When I do it, do I have to initialize it as multidimensional, or what if I discover that I just do a one dimension and then I get to the second?
You would have to go back and declare it as a multidimensional array. Because if you just declared like number 7, or even would work a lot better. So like number 6, and then decided you wanted to think of it as being about 2x3. When you type in like numbers like 1, 2, the computer has no idea what you're talking about, because it doesn't know how long the rows are or how high the columns are, and it can't really do anything with that notation. So if you want to use a multidimensional array, you'd have to go back to your initialization and type in the size of one index and the size of the other index, like the length of each one. And then you can reference them accordingly later. Any other questions about multidimensional arrays? Okay. Arrays in general, do they seem to make at least some kind of sense? Maybe the way to use them in C? That's what I was going to talk about next, in fact. All right. So let me just make sure I'm covering everything I want to get to with strings for you, or with arrays for you first. Oh, just one other thing that's very important to talk about in arrays before we get to strings and I want to cover is suppose I have some function and I want to act on an array. You know, normally when you're passing an argument to a function, so far you've just been passing some type of variable, like an integer x or a character c or something like that. But what if I had, say, an array of numbers or something similar that I wanted to pass to a function and then do something specific to it? So do you think I would pass it in a very similar manner to how I pass a normal variable? Is it essentially the same thing? Is there some kind of distinction? Oh, and by the way, if you ever had a very small array and just wanted to initialize each value to something specific, you can actually use this notation, just curly braces, and a comma-separated list. Like if I wanted to just put 0, 2, 4, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, that would actually set all the values in the array of numbers to those in order. So 0 would be 0, 1 would be 2, 2 would be 4, 3 would be 6, and so on. This is a lot less useful when you're dealing with much larger arrays, and you're going to find yourself using things like for loops to initialize your arrays a lot more often. But if you ever, for example, just had to keep track of like a short list of related things that were constant, this is just a useful way of declaring that, and which you might find helpful in the future. So I'm showing you. Okay, so suppose I wanted to write a function which takes whatever value is living at index 2 and then multiplies it by 2. So I could call it it's just having a, we'll make it an int just for now, because just we're not sure what we're going to be returning. Int mult 2 by 2. And I don't like that. 2 by 2. Okay. And it takes in this array of numbers. But that just looks like a regular int. So when you're passing an array, you can just add these two square brackets. You don't have to include anything inside them as long as you've already declared that. The computer knows how long it is, and you just need to pass it in with those square brackets to indicate that it is, in fact, an array. This will pass the array numbers to this function. And then can you tell me what the line of code I would write would be to multiply whatever is in this second element of the array by 2? By second, I mean at index 2, not the actual second, which lives at index 1. Okay, so I get numbers 2 equals, and then what? You just use the same square bracket notation to reference the value that lives there, and multiply it by 2. So the second index value of the array numbers, you set it equal to whatever currently lives there, which in this case would be 4, multiply it by 2, and it stores it there. So we should end up with this value, which is now 8, and our array will be changed to reflect that. Or will it be? Because we dealt with an example earlier where we updated a variable, and then when we tried to print it out later, we got no changes because we didn't return anything. So are we falling into the same trap now, or are we having yet another issue? Do we have to do something? Do we have to return anything from this function, or is this going to be different this time around? Okay, it seems like it makes a lot of sense that we'd have to return this array. But one of the things we noticed earlier is that can we just return the entire array? Because we couldn't set an array. Well, the only way you can really initialize an array is by using this curly brace notation to kind of set each value like that. But you can't really do the same thing to set two arrays equal to each other. Like if I have an array called numbers and an array called numbers 2, and they're the same length, and I want to make one equal to the other, I can't just use the assignment operator. I actually have to use a for loop and copy one at a time. So entire arrays are kind of, they're not like these singular values. They're kind of these data structures that contain a lot of variables within them. And they can't be made equal to each other in such a way. So it seems like if I were to try to return it and set the array equal to this new array, that doesn't really work. So we're actually saved at this point because the way arrays are passed to functions in C is by reference rather than by value. So there's two ways to pass a parameter to a function. There's pass by value, which is what we're seeing normally, and I showed you on a stack diagram I drew here earlier, where you pass a standard data type in C, like int or char, some kind of variable which contains a singular value to a function. It takes whatever is stored there and places it in a local variable. When you pass an array, which is just this region of memory which contains multiple variables which may contain some types of values, what's actually happening is it's passing a reference to that array, which means that it's telling the function where it can find numbers, where it can find this array. And then when we type in something like numbers 2, it's telling it, okay, now that you've found where numbers is, you go to the second index, and that's where the variable is in memory. So what we're essentially doing is reaching in to where we've placed all these numbers, going to the second index value, and changing it. We're actually reaching into the same memory and the same variables that we were using in our main function within our mult 2 by 2 function. And if we run this, you see when you pass it, you have to use the same notation with the square brackets. You'll see that if we print the integer, which is stored at numbers 2, we'll end up getting 8. Unless we get an error in GCC, which we did. expected expression before the right square bracket in line 15. Oh, pardon. You can actually just pass the name, rather. It's only in the function declaration that you have to include the square brackets to indicate that it is, in fact, an array. In the same way that you wouldn't have to type like int number or int x when you're calling the function, you can just pass the name because the program already knows that what it's dealing with that name. Oh, and since we made this int originally, just as part of the demonstration, we can actually make it void because we're not returning anything. We're changing the array because we have access to it. Sorry about that. Okay. Now if we were to run the function, and we see that, although I didn't print a new line character, you can see that it does in fact return an 8, so we were able to get to the second element in that array despite not being not returning anything. We were passed it by reference and were able to reach into that specific location in memory and alter it. This is not true for standard variables, and you have to remember to return something and assign it to that variable because you're not able to pass those by reference yet. You'll learn in a couple weeks a way we can use pointers to pass other types of data by reference and learn a little more about the nature of arrays. But for now, just consider them as two distinct ways of passing regular data variables and arrays independently of each other. Okay, so like I had mentioned earlier, we should definitely talk about strings now. Strings, as you've probably seen using arg. Have we used argv for any problems? No, we're going to use that this upcoming problem set. Has anyone looked at crypto yet? Okay, so you might have noticed every time we declare a main, we are including this argument called char star argv, and it has those square brackets. So what we've learned today, we can kind of see that it's an array. And we've talked about a little lecture about how a char star really means a string. So I guess a char star array would be an array of strings. But don't worry too much about that just yet. But let's look at char stars themselves. So if a char star is a string and a string is an array of characters, so strings, if they're an array of characters, must be similar to an array of integers. So when I provide a word, maybe I prefer the word like cat, it's kind of being placed into an array of fixed length, and the first entry is filled with the letters, the English letter C, then the letter A, then the letter T, and then there's something here, a backslash zero. And this character comes at the end of any string, and what it basically says is, okay, we've reached the end of this string, this is the terminating character. So this amount of memory has been reserved, so we could have a word which has up to 6 entries, which would essentially amount to 5 meaningful letters, and then this terminating character, because this must be the end of any string. And this is essentially just how strings are represented in memory. Does anyone know what ASCII is? A-S-C-I-I? Are you familiar with the term? Okay, so some of you are nodding your heads a little bit. You've probably heard it in passing. ASCII is essentially just the way that numbers are mapped to letters in the C in programming. Essentially, pretty widely accepted way of doing this. So numbers between 0 and 255 are all mapped to different letters and symbols that you might see on your keyboard, and some you might not even. And you can actually look this up at ascii-table.com, ASCII-table.com, and there's also some resources available on the cs50.net website, I believe, which can show you ways of finding out exactly how integers and characters are related and how characters can be related, represented by numbers. But essentially what's happening here is this number is placed in the array at this entry, and it's made to represent a letter, and that's just essentially how strings are represented in memory. We have these char data types, which are placed in an array followed by this terminating character. Any questions about how strings are represented?
I guess, in terms of adding a string, I don't know, let's say I want to put a word into memory. I guess kind of going by what we do with the numbers, is it kind of C, position 0 equals C position 1 equals A position, you know, is that happening behind the scenes? Or, I mean,
it's generally going to happen behind the scenes, because no one wants to, like, write in their code again and again, you know, okay, now get this letter from the inputs, now get this letter and place it here. That'd be kind of reinventing the wheel every time you want to get input. So there's a lot of standard functions. In C, there's a function called scanf, as well as some others. We've kind of hidden those behind the scenes just for now. We're using things like getInt and getLongLong to get input from the user. But there, you can also easily write functions to get, like, string input, and that's generally what you're going to do. No one really rewrites these functions very often. They're pretty standard. They can be found in a lot of libraries that can tell you to... I'm referencing, of course, header files, which are also referred to as libraries. They contain other functions which you can include in your code and make use of the code others have used to prevent yourself from having to do the same thing over and over. You see this with functions like printf. Like, we could write functions which take this data and then, like, write it straight to the screen using these complicated, like, low-level functions, but instead we have one that takes an entire string and puts it on the screen for us. So we use something very similar to get string input and then do something with it in memory. This information is just important because now that you know how it's stored in memory, if you want to take a look at each of these letters and maybe, and I'm saying this very suggestively, do something to each of the letters, like you might, if you wanted to perhaps scramble them or change them in a certain manner, you'd be able to do that now. And just to refer a little more to what is becoming quite obvious, the subject of cryptography, does anyone have any questions about the Caesar or Vigenère ciphers, just first off? The Caesar or Vigenère ciphers? Okay, they're covered in lecture, and we can talk a little bit more about them after class. I want to get to something else very quickly, just since we're running out of time. Just methods of changing the letters in a string to encrypt it in a certain way. I'd like to talk really briefly about methods by which you can alter the value which is found in a character within C. And it's a method called typecasting. Is anyone familiar with that phrase, typecasting, in terms of, like, programs? Okay, so if I have the letter A, I know that that's represented in ASCII as a number, and I also know that A through Z are in order in those numbers. So if I wanted to increase this by 1 and make it move on to B, I mean, A plus 1 seems kind of weird, but because, I mean, that's a number and a variable. So what if I were to do that? What if I were to do this very quickly? And then I want to do printf %c. Okay, so I'm increasing this capital A by 1 and then printing out whatever the result is. So will I get B? C undeclared. Oh, that's a char. I do get B. So it turns out that when I'm incrementing it by 1, it knows how to do that with a char. And another way you could do this is with typecasting, and it looks a little more sensical when you look at it in terms of typecasting, even though the compiler would do it under the hood for you. So if I were to look at A as an int, what that essentially does is takes the bits and bytes which make up A and converts that into an integer. It's just looking at the same information in a different way, assuming it's a number. And then I could add 1 to that. So now I have this integer which represents A, and I'm adding 1 to it, incrementing it by 1. And then I could typecast that as a char by placing the type I want to typecast it in front of it, inside parentheses. And then that would represent the letter B. Does everyone see how that kind of works, how the notation for typecasting makes sense? Okay, but as you've just seen,
you don't actually have to do it.
If you take a character like that of type char and add 1, it knows to increase it by 1 along the ASCII table, and it'll give you the next letter. Keep in mind that if you get to Z, you're going to want to make some kind of condition to loop around to the beginning if you want to continue to loop through alphabetical characters. Okay. And okay, does anyone have any further questions on the topic of typecasting and using char types? Okay, great. We're all set. Thank you, guys.